1 Corinthians 10:13, the 27th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on August 24, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm going to do something a little bit different today. I basically want to talk about one verse. And the reason I want to talk about that one verse is that this particular verse sort of looms large in my particular story, my journey as a Christian. So I just wanted to kind of back up and talk about it a little bit. The verse is verse 13 of chapter 10. No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. That's the translation from the New American Standard. This is a hard verse, I think. I still have some questions about some of the details and what Paul is saying here. But what I would like to do is just talk about it a little bit and give you some tools that will be helpful in making our way toward what Paul is basically getting at, what the issue is. Because I think there are two very different sorts of approaches we can take to what Paul is doing here. And in my early days as a Christian, I was very familiar with one of those paths. I read this and I thought it sounded like it was saying something in particular, and people around me told me that it was saying this thing. The way I understood it, the way I was told I should understand this passage, was the issue here is a greatly encouraging word from Paul about how we can successfully battle the temptation to sin. Every day we face various temptations to sin, and the question is, how can I be victorious in the midst of those temptations? How can I make sure that I don't give in, but that I actually overcome and do not fall into sin in my day-to-day life? Well, now we know, as James told us, that God is not the source of these temptations. God does not tempt anyone, James said. So we know that these temptations that we're facing are not from God, but although God didn't put the temptations there, we do know that He has not left us alone in the battle. In each situation where I am tempted to sin, God has built in, has provided, has stuck into the situation a way out. There is a way for me to go where, instead of falling into that sin, I can grab a hold of the way out, the escape hatch, and find myself removed from the temptation. So, how do you avoid falling into sin in your life? As you find yourself in the midst of temptation, you look for and avail yourself of the way out, the means of escape. And now, as a young Christian, I was very interested in this verse because I was very aware of the depths of the problem of sin. I became a Christian at the age of 18 from having been an atheist, and so I sort of jumped in with both feet. What is this new thing about? And I discovered about myself what I had never known before, and that was that I was actually not a very good person. And now that I had some incentive to try to be a good person, I discovered how hard that was, and in fact, how little I actually looked like what it was I was trying to accomplish. So this verse seemed to provide a very practical, life-changing sort of perspective on things. In fact, nowhere else in the Bible do I see this particular piece of advice, so this is like a key verse from the perspective that I was taught back then. God has provided me a way not to sin. And so it's up to me to find that way so that I might be victorious. I read recently in the notes of the New Geneva Study Bible this comment, which rings very true to me from my early experience with this verse. The note says, "This well-known verse has provided great encouragement to Christians faced by temptations. At the same time, Paul's words contain an implicit rebuke. If God keeps us from temptations greater than we can withstand, we cannot plead our temptations as an excuse for sinning. Sin is never a necessity for a believer." So, here we see, on the one hand, this is a great encouragement, but on the other hand, there is this rebuke in it. If you find yourself sinning, it's because you didn't take the way of escape. Because, after all, God has not tempted you beyond, or let you be in temptations beyond what you can bear. So, you could have not done it, and therefore, it's your fault you did it. What a tricky sentence that is. Of course it's my fault I did it. But there's an extra added level to this. The idea is, sure, if I were on my own without resources from God, I would have fallen into sin, but there are resources there that I could have availed myself of somehow. There is a way out that I could have taken, only I didn't. So not only am I guilty of sinning, but I'm guilty of not having taken the way out. Well, I was very aware of this tension in this verse. And in fact, I would put it now in the genre of a whole series of verses that were used in my life to give me what I have two things in my mind. I refer to them as the good news, bad news theology, or sometimes I refer to it as the catch-22 theology. Either one will work. Imagine that I have a fatal disease and that the only cure for my disease is a mineral that is found only on the moon. So I'm hopeless. I mean, there's no way that I'm going to be able to get to the moon and get this mineral. So God comes along and graciously goes to the moon, gets this mineral, and brings it to Earth and puts it in a safe for safekeeping. So it's come all the way down from the moon to the earth. That's the good news. The bad news is I don't know the combination to the safe. So it's the so close and yet so far theology as well. I mean, however you want to put it. That idea that God has done something for me and now it's up to me to avail myself of the thing that God has done. And the only problem is I can't figure out how to do it. It doesn't seem to work. So another one of those kind of verses is, "Walk by the Spirit and you will not carry out the desires of the flesh." I couldn't tell you how many times I had conversations with other believers. What does that mean, walk by the Spirit? Do you know how to do it? When you do it, what does it look like? How does that happen? So I was trying as hard as I could to walk by the Spirit as I was being taught to do, certain mental attitude and so forth. And yet I was still carrying out the desires of the flesh at times. So what did that mean? Another verse that was told me was, "God has given us everything pertaining to life and godliness." God has already given you everything you need to arrive at godliness. You've got it right now. So if you're not godly, the fault is yours, because God has given you everything you need to get there. And once again, there I was stuck. How do I turn myself into the sort of person that can avail myself of all of this godliness that God has already given me? Kind of the overall sort of statement of this, another theme like that, "All things you ask in prayer, believing, you shall receive." Well, once again, great. But my experience was that I asked for all kinds of things that I didn't get. So what does that mean? Did that mean I didn't have enough faith, that I didn't really believe? And of course, I was told that by some people. And then there's this verse here, that idea that God has provided the way out so that I needn't give in to temptation. The idea basically that there is no excuse for me to be sinning because God has given me something that will get me out of it if I avail myself of it. So, the good news, bad news theology basically is this message God has provided you with everything you need to conquer sin, to find life now, abundance now. But if it's not working, it's your fault. You must not have enough faith. You must not be doing it right. So you have that situation where you have this good news that God has done this wonderful thing for you, but it doesn't seem to have been enough. And now I can't say, God, help me, because his answer is, I did help you. I gave you everything you need for life and godliness, and yet I'm still not there. So whatever the deficit is, it's in my court. I'm the one who has to make it up in order to somehow solve this problem. Well, that issue was a huge issue to me in my early days as a Christian. As many of you know, probably the reason that I'm standing here teaching the Bible now is because of those struggles in the early days. I just could not rest with my understanding of the gospel as it stood, because it was just tearing me up. I mean, what is the problem here? What is this supposed to look like? So I always give that warning when I'm talking about these sorts of things. This is not a matter of indifference to me. The answer to the question, what sort of thing is Paul doing in a verse like this, is very significant, very important. And I have come down on a particular side that is, surprise, different than what I was taught before. You thought I was going to say that I agreed with all of that stuff, didn't you? Ha, no, of course not. When have you ever said, have you ever heard me say, you have heard it said and I agree? No. That's just not it. So let me see if I can sort out for you here what I think is happening in this verse. And I want to do that by starting with the word temptation, because I think that's the key to understanding what Paul is getting at here. At least one of the important keys. The Greek word that we have translated temptation here in the New American Standard is a very important Greek word in New Testament theology. It shows up in a number of very important passages, and the theme associated with this word is very important. We need to understand that there are kind of two ways that it can be translated. And both of them are legitimate depending on the context and what the issue is, what sort of picture there is. One of the legitimate ways to translate this word is temptation, to tempt. And you have that picture when somebody is tempting, that they are enticing. I am tempting you. I am trying to get you to do something that you shouldn't do. We would describe Satan as tempting Jesus in the wilderness. He was trying to get him to come over to his side in one way or another. He was trying to get him to do something faithless and unbelieving. Okay, so that idea of the temptation, the enticement, that's a legitimate way of translating this word. But actually, I would say more often in the New Testament, the better way to translate this, more context in the New Testament, use this word to talk about a test or a trial. Now, the idea of the test is different. If I am testing you, I am not necessarily enticing you. I am not necessarily trying to get you to do wrong. I have put you in a situation where I want to see what sort of a person you are. So, the distinction, I hope, is clear. To tempt has that sort of association with it, that idea that I am trying to get you to sin. The idea of the test is merely, it is a situation which is designed to show what's true. Some question is being tested. Are you a person of faith? Let's put it to the test and see what's going on. So there are some important distinctions that I think we would want to make here. One of them is that distinction that I've just made, the distinction between these two ideas, the idea of the enticement versus just the idea of the test, of seeing what's going on. Another important distinction is how we view what is at stake. And here's what I mean. We tend to associate with the word temptation the idea of any sort of sin that might come along in my life. You're being irritating and I'm tempted to respond with irritation myself. Is something that is enticing me, tempting me to think things I shouldn't think or to do things I shouldn't do or something like that. Whereas the New Testament idea of testing, of trials, is not usually fundamentally about the issue of sin. I'm not being tested to see whether I'm a sinner. That's already a settled issue. I am a sinner. And I am going to see in the circumstances of my life that I am a sinner. I will find evil in myself as I go along through life. I will find myself being selfish and unloving and unwilling to submit to God's restrictions on my life. Those things will happen to me at times. I will see that in myself. The New Testament idea of testing, though, is testing my heart, testing to see whether, in fact, I have made that fundamental shift. I have that kind of heart that is open to the truth of God. In other words, a believing heart. Do I believe that the gospel is true? Will I admit that I am a sinner and that I need God's mercy? Will I recognize that life, true life, is to be found in the kingdom of God and not in anything this world has to offer? Those are the kinds of issues that I face in life. I say I believe, I come forward, I join a church or whatever, and I am a Christian. But the circumstances of my life are going to give me the opportunity to actually decide whether this is for me or not, whether I'm actually going to embrace it and make it my own. We could talk quite a bit. I have on other occasions, and I'm not going to do it this morning, but we could talk about the nature of trials and the sorts of things that God does, the kinds of situations we find ourselves in that force us to confront fundamental issues. Maybe it confronts me with the question, am I a sinner or not? Maybe it confronts me with the question, what is it that I really want in life? Do I really believe that God is there and He is good, or am I counting on something else in life? Those are the kinds of fundamental issues that we face in a trial. In the midst of those trials, we may sin, we may fail, we may do all kinds of things, but the issue isn't whether I sin on one occasion or another. The question is whether I persevere. Now that it has become clear what's at stake, whether I hang in there and hold on to the gospel as my own. We see this described in Romans, we see this described in James, we see it described in Hebrews, we see it described in 1 Peter. This is a major theme in the New Testament, the idea that God takes us through things to clarify the issue for us. What is it that my life is about? So, the distinction here that I want to make is a crucial one for understanding our experience, for understanding New Testament theology. There's the issue of whether I'm a sinner, and there's the issue of whether I'm a believer, of whether I have a heart for God, whether I have eyes to see and ears to hear. And what life will show, ultimately, is that every human being is a sinner. You will see the evidence of it in my life. I will see the evidence of it in yours. I see the evidence of it in my own. But for some people, those whose eyes are open by the grace of God, you will see a life that shows the evidence that the gospel is real to that person, that this is what I want. As much as I may fail as a sinner at times, I know I'm a sinner, I want to be forgiven, I want to find life. I want the conquest of death. I want God to rule in my life. As I find myself praying fervently sometimes, and I'm serious when I say this, but one of my most common prayers is for me to cry out to God, God, I want you to win. Because I feel like I'm in this battle, and at times I'm trying to, you know, it's like I'm in this wrestling match with God, and I'm saying desperately to Him, I don't want to win this battle. I want you to win this battle. It's that sort of submission to God, ultimately, that God is there, that his mercy is what I need, and all of that, that I will find myself facing in the midst of life. And that's the sort of thing that the Bible means by a trial. It's when I face in a fundamental way, what is my life about? So, that's a crucial distinction. The distinction between being a sinner and being an unbeliever. We're all sinners, but not all of us have hearts that are hardened against God. And the trials ultimately will show that. The second distinction I think that is important is that, as I mentioned before, when we look at this verse and we translate it temptation, typically commentators will make the comment, we know that God isn't the source of this because James says God doesn't tempt anybody. But this is where it's so important to know how we're translating this word and how we understand it. Because the biblical message is, God may not tempt, but he does test. He is absolutely the source of my tests, of my trials in life. The book of James is a great example. Because the book of James is all about the trials of our faith that God puts us through. The big example that James uses in his book is the example of Abraham. And we have explicitly in the Old Testament and in the New Testament statements about how God tested Abraham. Using this very word that we're talking about here, Hebrews uses this word that we're talking about translating as tempting and saying God did this to Abraham. He tested Abraham. And we know what he's talking about there. It's the time when he was asked to offer up Isaac on the altar. He didn't tempt him, but he did test him. He put him in a situation to show what sort of a person he was. So James is saying basically, God tests, but he does not tempt in the sense that, and I think what James means there is, there's an excuse that the people that he's talking to might use. He's talking about the trials that God is putting us through. And you might argue, oh, sure, so I'm in this tug of war with God. Here I am in all my innocence trying to do the right thing, and here's God, the creator of everything, pulling and trying to make me sin. Of course I'm going to lose. I mean, how am I supposed to win a battle like that? And what James is saying is, no, that's not the picture. God is not out there pulling on innocent little you trying to get you to sin. The motivation for sin comes from you. You're the one who's doing the pulling. It is your own evil heart that provides the power and attraction in this. God is not out there trying to get you to sin. You are, in the midst of tests, rather, living out, embodying what you are yourself at heart. The distinction is a crucial one again, then, because if we're talking about temptation, no, that's not something God did. But if we're talking about testing, absolutely. That is very much on God's agenda. So these distinctions that I'm trying to make here, that temptation implies that attempt to entice, whereas testing is just seeing what you're made of. The distinction between sin on the one hand and what we could call faithlessness, unbelief, that sort of thing on the other hand, that the test is about my faith, about my heart before God. Not my sinfulness, but whether I have a heart that is willing to know the truth about myself and about God and to live in the light of that. And then finally, the idea that if we're talking about tests, God, it is very much something that God has brought into our lives deliberately. So that distinction, I think, is a very crucial one. And now I suppose it would not be surprising for you if I tell you that I would like to propose that temptation is the wrong way to translate this in the verse that we're looking at. This is not talking about temptation, it's talking about testing, which is what Paul usually talks about. This is a big theme for Paul. One of the ways we can know that, I think, is if we consider the idea that God tests, we see that in the story of Abraham, as I mentioned, James refers to that. Abraham was tested by God. But there is another place in the Old Testament where it talks about God testing people. and it is the story of the Exodus, Israel's journey through the wilderness. In several places throughout that story and afterwards, it is said that God tested Israel to see what was in their hearts. Well, funny thing, we're in 1 Corinthians 10. The whole context is about the story of Israel's journey through the wilderness and how essentially the problem of the Israelites was not just that they were sinners, it's that they were hard-hearted and unbelieving against God. God sends plagues, parts the Red Sea, sends the manna, sends the quail, supernaturally brings water from the rocks, guides them with the cloud and the fire. And how do they respond? They keep accusing Moses of trying to kill them. And finally, when they get to the edge of the promised land, they say, "Let's kill Moses and go back to Egypt." That's just not falling into a little temptation along the way. This is a fundamental, extended experience of the power and mercy of God, together with an absolute rejection, a refusal to know God as he has revealed himself. That's what happened to Israel. Paul's point, as we talked about last week in the part up above, is that here you have the Israelites. They were all a part of the community. They were all a part of Moses and his people. And yet, being a part of the community, sharing in the experience of the community, was not enough, because individually, most of them were hard-hearted against God, and ultimately they were condemned. They rebelled, they rejected God, and they paid the consequence. So the whole point that Paul has been making to the Corinthians is, you know, you guys, I know you've shown up and you say you believe in Jesus and you've been baptized and you have communion and all that stuff, but you have to, if you think you're standing, you had better take heed lest you fall. Don't get cocky about this. Right now, you guys are in the midst of trials of your faith, and it doesn't look so good. A number of you have set the things of this world at a higher premium than the promises of God. What does that mean? What are you about? Stop and take stock. What is it in the end that you believe? Do you believe the gospel? Do you trust God? Do you know what it is that he has promised? Do you know what it is that you need? This is the opportunity for you to confront that in the midst of some real life situations. That's the context that we're talking about here. Paul is not just talking about plain old vanilla sin, if I can call it that. I mean, it's all of us find ourselves falling into sin, being less than what we want to be, what we ought to be as people. The issue in the context that we're looking at is running the race, persevering, winning the prize, versus falling away, living faithlessly, abandoning God as Israel did in the wilderness. That's the context. That's what the issue is in this section. In other words, Paul is talking about trials. He is talking about the circumstances of their life that are pushing them up to the big question. Do I want this or not? Do I believe it or not? Sure, I said I do, but now something's at stake. Something's on the table, and I'm having to decide whether this actually means something to me or not. I think this distinction, making this decision about this word, is the most important decision we have to make about this verse. So I would argue, let's go back to the New American Standard Translation, and I want to make a revision to it. We change that word. No trial has overtaken you but such as is common to man, and God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tested beyond what you are able, but with the trial will provide the way of escape also, that you may be able to endure it. Okay? So, we've made a revision that I think brings us much closer to what it is Paul has in mind. This whole context is about, are you going to stand or are you going to fall? Take heed. Pay attention. You are in the midst of the trials of your faith. Paul has been saying some very sobering things here. I mean, this is serious stuff, talking about falling away and not winning the prize and not inheriting eternal life and all of that. Verse 13 is meant to be an encouragement, but a particular kind of encouragement. God has determined that he is going to test our faith, but he is not setting out to destroy us. I think Paul is speaking to a certain fear that is rightly based, that we understand that we are weak enough that if God were to put enough pressure on us, we would certainly break. There is only so far that my faith and my strength will take me. But that is not what God is doing. This is not like a lab where you test to failure. He is not pushing us until we break. The idea is to bring out in the people of God the reality of their faith. He will not allow us to be tested beyond what we are able to bear. I think that's what Paul is saying here. What he's trying to say to us, to them, is that yes, there is something very serious going on here. But in this, it is not that God is setting out to break us. He is setting out to test us. And he is not going to do that beyond what we can take. Take in the sense of, as believers, remain faithful in the midst of. So there is no promise here that I have the power to conquer every sin. He's not saying that God will, no circumstance in my life is ever going to provide a situation that is going to bring me to sin. That's not the issue. The issue is whether in my testing, in the trials of my life, whether I'm going to break or not, whether I can bear it, whether I can endure it. And what he's saying is, God is not, he is faithful. His testing of our faith is not a violation of his faithfulness to us or his promises. Yes, he's pushing us hard, but he is still faithful and will not push us beyond what we can bear. Okay. Now, let me make a comment then, see if we can refine this a little bit more. There's this language, the way of escape. What are we going to do with that? This is a tricky one, and I have to say that I'm still sorting this out a little bit. This is a tricky word in Greek. It can go a number of different ways. I think there are kind of three contenders here, at least, maybe more, but three that struck me as being contenders. One of them does what they're calling the way of escape. This word can mean something like the way out or the exit. Literally, it was used, one context you find it, the idea is, you know, a ship has been traveling on the ocean, and typically this word seems to be associated with the ocean when it's used in this way. And you've come to the shoreline and there is no harbor. There is no place you can go in and get up to the shore and have a disembarking point. We're looking for the disembarking point. Where can we land and get off this boat? And this word seems to imply something like that. We couldn't find a place to get off. Secondly, this word can mean sometimes the end or conclusion, you know, the finish. And then, finally, although there are other things too, this word sometimes is used in the sense of the outcome or the result. The one other place where it's used in the New Testament is in Hebrews, and it seems to be used in that sense there, the idea of the outcome or the result. It doesn't mean the way out. In Hebrews, the place where it's used, the other place in the New Testament, it doesn't mean exit or way out. It means something like outcome or result. So, what are we going to do with that then? Well, we're looking at the situation here where God is described as not only making our trials, but also making a place to get off, a finish, or the outcome. So it seems to me that there are kind of two kinds of ideas that Paul might be talking about here. First of all, he might be emphasizing the fact that God has set a limit on how much he will trust us. Again, it is not the testing to failure, but that literally then it would say something like, God will make, together with the trial, the end also, the finish also, to be able to endure it. So Paul might be saying something like, God is not only starting this, but he will finish it. Something like that. There is another more powerful claim that Paul might be making, and I have to say I'm attracted to this one at this point. This is to take it in the sense that it is used in Hebrews of outcome or result. And the idea would be that for the people of God, God has not only provided the test, but he is also determining the outcome. He is going to make sure, in other words, that you pass. Literally, it would be translated, God will make, together with the trial, the outcome also, to be able to endure it. And there, the idea would be that to be able to endure it is that outcome that he is determining. Not only is he taking you through the trial, but he is assuring that you will pass, if in fact you are one of his people. And that would be the implication that has to be read here. Not everyone who's tried passes, but for those who belong to God, there is nothing that can separate us from his love, as Paul says. We know this is a biblical idea. I think we could find many places that imply that God has his hand on his people, will bring us successfully to the end. Paul speaks of God as the God who gives perseverance. So it's quite possible that Paul might have something like that in mind. The key is, either way, that we are not, Paul is not saying, if you ever find yourself tempted to sin, look for the escape hatch that God has built somewhere, and that's the way to avoid sinning. Instead, his word is a basic word of encouragement. Yes, you are being tested. You are in the midst of trials that are forcing you to confront the question of whether you will be faithful and hold on to God and his promises or not. But let me remind you in the midst of this that God is faithful and that he will not test us beyond what we can take. It is not his intention to break us. It is his intention to test us. And he will bring it to its conclusion, either stop it before it's too late or else actually bring about the desired outcome. Something like that, I think, is what he's getting at. Now, let me just say that I'm not entirely satisfied with exactly how I'm taking each of the little details here. I'm still in the market for an even more satisfying way of putting together what he's saying. What is clear to me in the context is that the issue is trials and not temptations to sin, and that his basic assurance has to do, it is in the midst of a very sobering discussion about how we must face into the issue of whether we believe this or not in the midst of the trials of our life, there is this reassurance that God is faithful and that he is not out to do us in this process. That seems clear to me in what Paul is saying. The details are a little tricky. Let me make a couple of closing comments, and I want to leave room for questions. First of all, it seems to me that an implication of what we find here, and we find this in many other places as well, but I just want to remind you of it, God's fingerprints are all over our sufferings. That sort of theological move that tries to make it that God didn't bring any of this bad stuff around, he's just the one who brings the good stuff, in the sense that he would never actually himself move in such a way to put us in harm's way or something like that. That's just a fiction. That's not true. Paul says it explicitly here. God makes, together with our trials, also the outcome or the conclusion. He makes the trials and he makes the outcome. Both of those things he makes. Having faith, living out our faith, growing in our faith, these things are so important to God that He is willing for those He truly loves to sacrifice their comfort for the sake of their maturity and strength. To have to face into the real issues of life and decide, what do I believe? What is life about for me? To find in myself the grace to persevere and hang on to the gospel in the midst of things that would try to tear it out of my grasp. From God's perspective, that's the most important thing that I could go through. It is much more important than being comfortable or even being happy in the short term. My happiness ultimately is very much God's concern, but He knows in the long run it's not going to be good for me to be happy and oblivious. It is better to be uncomfortable and wise. So we don't want to shy away from saying God has got us in these situations. It is His determination to do so. We also want to be encouraged, I think, by what Paul is saying here. God is not a sadist. He is faithful. Even though He is, in fact, the one who is bringing us into these difficult situations, He is faithful. He is not trying to destroy us. He is on our side. It is His love that leads us to test us, to discipline us. It is not that He is some sort of a sadist. It is that He is on our side. And finally, I just want to again make the comment about the good news, bad news theology. I am standing here before you committed to the idea that there is no such thing. The Bible is not about that. This good news, bad news, in the sense that the good news is that God has traveled millions of miles so that He's only a couple of miles away from you. And so, boy, it's almost taken care of. And the bad news is your legs are broken and you can't move. That sort of theology that comes back around and says, you could solve this problem. You could have less suffering. You could be sinning less. Whatever, you could be victorious and have a successful ministry or whatever it might be. If you would just get it together and get out there and grab what you've got coming to you, I'm committed to the idea that that is an unbiblical idea. That is not what the Bible is teaching. In a conversation, I guess I mentioned that earlier, I also refer to this as catch-22 theology. I don't know if you remember Catch-22, the book. This was a favorite book of mine when I was in high school. I think Catch-22 is a high school sort of book in a lot of ways. High school boys. Catch-22 is one of those kind of books. I thought it myself so sophisticated for reading Catch-22. But the idea in Catch-22 is it's about a character, Yossarian, who is desperate to get out of the army during World War II. Because he is having these horrendous experiences. I mean, gruesome, horrendous experiences in war. And he wants out. He's trying to find a way out. And there is a rule that says, if you are insane, you can get out of the army. But catch-22 is that anybody who wants to get out of the army is obviously sane. So the only people who are eligible to get out are ones who don't want to. That's catch-22. That idea that there's that thing that comes along and turns it on its head so that what sounded like a good deal turns out not to be. Well, at least in my experience, so many of the promises that I heard as an early Christian were like that. I'm not saying that God is not real and He is not involved in our lives and that He is not doing things for us now. He absolutely is. But those sorts of theologies that say, here is the technique, here is the thing that you can do. And if you're suffering now, it's because you haven't done the thing that you could do. There is this power available one way or another. I would argue that if we go to each of those passages that is supposedly evidence for such a thing, that that's not true. That's not what it's saying. And that it always comes back to this basic, fundamental question. There is not the question, first, am I a believer or am I not? And then, second, am I an overcoming, victorious believer or not? There is only one question. Am I a believer or not? That's the question that I am facing and being tested about in my life. If I persevere in hanging on to God and the promises of the gospel and the hope of forgiveness, then I am victorious. That is overcoming. There is no other kind of overcoming. The Bible only has one flavor, as far as I'm concerned. So, the issue is, it's a life and death one. It's a fundamental one, but it's a simple one. Is God there? Do I believe He's there? Do I want what it is He has promised? Will I know myself as His creature and a sinner before Him, in need of His mercy, and so on? That's the issue. Is this true or not? Do I want it or not? That's the issue we face. And if, in the midst of the difficulties, the struggles, the ugliness of failure and slipping around and messing up in all kinds of ways, I hang on to God and count on His faithfulness, then I am an overcomer. I am victorious. And that's the victory that counts. Okay, so there's my little spiel on that verse. You can tell I have feelings about it. So I'm ready for your questions, comments, whatever you might want to do. Wait for Roger to bring the mic around or whoever's got. Oh, there, Logan.
The use of the word, or the word that's translated, allow you to be tempted.
Yes.
Makes it sound like someone else is doing the tempting.
Yes.
So, sort of.
Yes.
And then, so we always hear about Joseph and Potiphar's wife here. Why is that not in a more, a less passive?
Right. Yeah, I thought about that. Certainly, for the case that I'm making, it would have been stronger, I wouldn't have to defend it as much, if Paul had said, God will not test you beyond what you are able. But I don't think the fact that he says, allow to be tested, implies that his hands are off of it. Because the means by which God is testing us is some sort of intermediate. There is somebody or something in this world that is the thing that I'm dealing with. So I am being tested by people, by circumstances, and that's, I think Paul would say that as well. I mean, he would say both things. It's not that God is just coming along, sweeping everybody out of the way, standing in my path and testing me. He's testing me through the circumstances of my life. So, I mean, we could look at Potiphar's wife and all of that, but the fact is, Joseph, when he sums it up at the end, his perspective is that, you know, it's the famous statement about you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. That idea that you were doing something, but God was doing something and you're doing something. So I think both of them go together. Yeah, it would be stronger if he had said, God will not test you beyond what you are able. But I don't think it changes it. The next sentence, he makes it clear, or the next phrase, he makes it clear that God is the one making both of them. He is making the trials, and he is also making the outcome, or whatever it is. So, yeah, but that is a good point.
I have two questions. So the word for temptation, it can also be implied test.
Yes. In fact, I think it's better to see it as the fundamental meaning is test. And occasionally, it's used in situations where the test is being administered by somebody who wants you to fail. So then it kind of takes on more of the sense of temptation. You could say that Jesus was tested in the wilderness. It would be accurate to say so. And this word is used there. It still has a great sense of testing in that situation. But we translate it temptation, and it's probably fair to do so, because there's Satan there trying to get him to to mess up. So Satan is tempting him. But I would say Satan is tempting him and God is testing him.
So, I mean, a lot of Christians today see that that the sin that comes toward that comes out of us is because of Satan's temptation,
mm-hmm.
and God sort of has a sort of hands-off attitude. So how would you respond, especially with this verse, to that type of concern?
Well, it's probably helpful to remember James' comment at this point. He was arguing against a different point, but it's still very relevant, it seems to me, that idea that, here, let me read it. Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. He wants to put the locus of the force here on my heart. Yeah, Satan may at times do things to tempt me, just as he did to Jesus. I don't know when in my life the powers of evil have actually arrayed themselves against me. I have no way of really knowing what's happening on that level. But in the end, it's the same problem. I mean, my experience of my own heart is such that if the powers of evil just stayed out of my way, basically, I'm quite capable of enticing myself into doing evil. I mean, the world itself has enough to attract me that I'm quite capable of going that way. So, in one way or another, these kinds of theological questions, it always comes back to that question that we talk about a lot around here and that Christians have such difficulty with. It's so controversial. But that question of what is God responsible for? And, you know, we live in a culture right now where, I mean, I just heard it the other day. I have this fatal disease. Every now and again I turn on the Christian TV just to see what's being said. And there was a guy saying, look, you know, God is the source of every good thing. So is poverty good? No. Sickness good? No. Let's just name whatever it might be. It's not good. So we know, ipso facto, it's not from God. It must be from Satan. So, and then therefore, so here is Satan sending bad things to you, and God's just, he's trying to send good things to you, but Satan's messing it up. And so I need to do something to kind of tip the balance to God so that he can win. And I know I say this a lot, but I am so infuriated by it that the message on those places is the thing you do to tip the balance is send them money. It is. You go and listen. It is. That's what they say. You show God that you mean business so that he can mean business with you. And how do you do that? Sometimes they just say, yeah, send me money. Sometimes you say, they just, you know, more, you know, give of your resources, plant your seed, you know, do that kind of stuff. But who, I mean, is anybody handy? Well, I'm handy. You know, you could send it to me if you can't find anybody else. It sounds very cynical, but I am very cynical about it because it's an awful thing. It is an awful, awful thing. So anyway, yeah, so we try to distance, you know, we can't handle the idea that somehow God would be so intimately involved in things that involve suffering and difficulty in our lives. And we do have a right instinct. We want to, God is not evil in any sense. So we need to put the picture together in a way that makes sense of the fact that God is not evil. I mean, that's true. So we see God, his hands are off whatever temptations might be coming my way. It's Satan that's doing it. I just think that's the wrong picture. The Bible doesn't really emphasize that. It doesn't really paint that picture very much. When it talks about it explicitly, like James did there, the source of the temptation is in me. I mean, the power of it, the draw, is not that I am innocent and Satan is trying to use his power to draw me for it, toward it. The power is in my own desires. I'm reeling it in. I mean, that's, you know, I'm pulling myself toward it or pulling it toward me. So in the end, it kind of doesn't matter to me. I mean, as I'm facing something where I have a choice before me about what to do and I'm torn, it doesn't really matter to me whether Satan is in there trying to pull me in one direction or not. He may very well be. And in the end, he will answer for that. But it really comes down to me and God. I mean, my crying out to God, I want your mercy. I want your help. I want to belong to you. I want you to bring me safely home. I mean, that's what I'm looking for.
The older I get, the more clear it is that the only problem I have is myself. And I think that other interpretation comes out of a naive understanding of sin that sees it primarily a matter of my finitude, that if there are just some circumstances outside of myself that I cannot control, and if God would just, when they think of God providing everything, he's done everything for me, he's going to do, they're thinking in terms of he solved all my problems that are not inherently inside me, and so therefore, since that's the only problem I have is being finite, then now I can go for it. And it just seems to me that that's not true at all. My main problem is me. And if it is in fact true that God's done everything for me that he's going to do, he has to have changed me. And if I am not changed, he hasn't done everything for me he's going to do.
Right.
Or it's just, it doesn't make any sense. So it's kind of a weird idea about sin.
Yeah.
My question about this is, what is Paul doing, trying to do with this verse? Because it seems to me that if you see it a particular way, it turns out to be a tautology. If you see his trying to comfort people, people who are asking, gosh, am I going to be able to survive these temptations? And, you know, is my faith going to survive? Am I going to make it? And Paul says, sure, you're going to make it because God won't test you too far. That's assuming, of course, you're a believer. And that's actually the question that they're asking. It seems like you could say, well, how do I know I'm a believer? Will I survive these trials? Well, how do I know I'm going to survive these trials? Well, if you're a believer. So whatever question you ask, you're left with a second question. So I'm wondering, it strikes me that there's something more, either different or more going on than Paul trying to comfort his audience. Because if I'm having a hard time figuring out how to incorporate my belief in God's sovereignty into, it seems to me that, let's say, for instance, I'm not a believer. If I'm not a believer, it's because God hasn't chosen me. If God hasn't chosen me, then am I not justified in not trusting him? Because he didn't give me what I needed to. I'm going around in circles. I'm just wondering if you have any response to that.
Yeah. Well, okay. See, the way you formulated it is not the way I'm thinking about it. I guess I would say I don't see this as addressed to someone who's in that spot. I'm wrestling with things. I'm wondering whether I'm a believer or not. And this is a word that says, don't worry, I know you're going to heaven. That's not what he's saying. As best I can understand right now, the issue would be more, the picture of God testing us and pushing us to the breaking point could inspire a kind of fear that would say no one could stand up to such a thing. I mean, how can I believe in the faithfulness of God and yet here's a God who's trying to break me, who's trying to push me to fail in this situation. And Paul's word of encouragement then is not saying to each one of you, I know that you're going to heaven or something like that, but he's saying, no, God's faithfulness and this picture of his testing us goes together, because he is faithful to, when you look at his people, he is determined, he is going to test them, and they are going to go through these things, and yet he is faithful to them, and he is not going to push them to the breaking point. something like that. Or in fact, he is, perhaps it's going as far as saying he has determined the outcome. So the idea is there some sort of contradiction in a picture of God taking the Israelites into the wilderness and all these terrible things happening to them and all of that, and the idea that we are being tested in that way? Is there some sort of contradiction between that and the idea that God loves us and is faithful to us as his people? And what he's saying is no. So yes, the question still remains, especially in this, he just got done saying, he who stands, let him take heed lest he fall. The question is very much on the table that I might fall. There's no guarantee here that I, Corinthian, whom listening to Paul, am going to make it. But what he's saying is, the fact that God is testing his people doesn't obliterate his faithfulness. That other statement that you made, Margaret, well, I don't know. You and I have talked about this for a long time now, and one of the two of us is seeing something that the other one is not. Either you're seeing something that I'm not, or I'm seeing something that you're not, or maybe we're both missing it. I don't know. That's a possibility too. But see, I don't think you can put it that way. It's a level, you're shifting levels when you say, if God hasn't chosen me, how could I trust him because he hasn't done this thing for me? We're talking about the transcendent choice of God out there behind the scenes, but for me as a human being, the offer is a real one. It's in front of me. If I will trust God, he will save me. It's not like he didn't choose me, so I'm going to decide to trust him even though he's untrustworthy. But I think, well, maybe, no, he seems like a good guy. I'll trust him anyway. And he looks at his list and says, no, I'm sorry. See, you know, I can't take you because you're not on the list. I know you're trusting me and everything. You don't have any reason to because I didn't put you on the list. But you went ahead and trusted me and to a, I'm sorry, what can I do? You're not on the list. So it's not like that. I mean, it's the offer is real. It is open in front of me. God is good. He is merciful to anyone who seeks his mercy. So in that sense, I have a reason to trust him. And if I don't, it's true. I believe that ultimately the election of God is behind it. But on my part, it is because I have evilly put aside the offer, the genuine offer that God has made and an understanding of God's character and thus am liable for having done so. So that's how I would put those things together. Those are hard questions. You know how it is. We get to these things and it's hard because, like I say, we're talking about the transcendent activity of God versus my real interaction in the world. And what's tricky is that when we're talking about God testing or God tempting and all of those kinds of things, there we're talking about God's interaction on my level as well. God has stepped into the world and put this in front of me, and I am interacting with it. Ultimately, behind the scenes, his whole story is working itself out. But here on my level, he has entered into my reality to give me this, and this is what I have to deal with. And I think in this kind of context, for the most part, it's helpful to try to keep it on that level. Roger, you want to? We'll make this the last one.
Would it be a good thing to have as a de facto, a default idea that if any time hardship comes my way, it's God's indirectly involved and it's a test? But I look at all hardships as being God's tests.
No. I think I should see, the way I put it, God's fingerprints on all of it. As God works all things together for good. There's nothing that has come into my life that has somehow gotten away from God or anything like that. But not every hardship is a test. I mean, a trial in that sense. I mean, I think many people could testify to facing some issue at a certain point in their life that maybe wasn't even a big issue, but it pushed them to that place where they really had to think about, what do I think of God? And then later on, having wrestled with it and basically come to a certain level of confidence in God in the midst of those trials, later on, something else comes along and it's even bigger than what that was. But it doesn't push me to question God the way that other thing did. Yes, I'm suffering. Yes, I'm hurting. But I basically, in the midst of it, remember who God is, and spiritually I get through it okay. Well, that's not really, you could call it a test, but I mean, that I passed, I guess, if you want. But the idea of trials really has to do with that spot where it pushes me to where I have to confront that question. So I don't think of every bit of suffering as a trial in that sense. I think, I mean, we don't know what God's up to, but the best that I can say is I look at my life and there are certain things as I look back on them and I say, you know, that seems to have been a real trial. That was like being put in the crucible and you know, let's burn out the dross and see if there's any real stuff left here. I just know it afterwards. That's what that was about. So that's kind of how I look at that. I think that's the idea. Okay. Well, thanks.